From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Heat Wave, we'll talk about the sociology of the urban inferno with Eric Kleinenberg. His new book examines the 1995 heat wave in Chicago, when over 700 people died. That's higher than the death toll of Hurricane Andrew, the San Francisco earthquake, and the Great Fire of Chicago combined. Also, we tag along with an insomniac. Comedian Dave Attell stays up late and travels around the country looking for a good time. It's all part of the fun on his late-night show on Comedy Central. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles Mirco Records, an obscure 60s label out of Shreveport, Louisiana. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. More than 600 relatives of people killed in last September's terrorist attacks filed a federal suit today against groups and people they say funded that attack. It's the first of what will probably be several civil suits. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
Tom Burnett is considered one of the heroes of Flight 93, which crashed in a Pennsylvania field. In a press conference, his father said the lawsuit will not fill the hole in his heart, but it can identify those who may have funded Al-Qaeda.
In taking this action, we will move terrorist financing schemes out of the shadows and into the light of day.
And he hopes financially cripple a host of Islamic charities, Saudi banks, and individuals, including three Saudi princes. But even the victims' relatives concede it will be an uphill battle to win the civil lawsuit. Already, other relatives are divided over which law firm should spearhead the case, and there's a question of whether people who joined this lawsuit may be disqualified to receive money from the government's Victim Compensation Fund. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Rebuild offices at the Pentagon that were destroyed in last year's terrorist attack began reopening today. Nearly two dozen Pentagon employees returned to their former office spaces. At least one of the workers said their return has important symbolism. Marine Corps attorney Peter Murphy says it demonstrates America's spirit will not be destroyed as easily as a building. President Bush's national security advisor says the U.S. has a powerful and moral case for removing Saddam Hussein as Iraq's president, but she says Mr. Bush has not yet decided how the U.S. will proceed. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
Condoleezza Rice told the BBC Saddam Hussein is an evil man who, if left unchecked, will wreak havoc again on Iraq and his neighbors, and, says Rice, the rest of the world if he obtains weapons of mass destruction.
If Saddam Hussein is left in power, doing the things that he's doing now, this is a threat that will emerge and emerge in a very big way. And history is littered with cases of inaction that led to very grave consequences for the world.
Iraq has denied it's trying to obtain chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, but Baghdad has blocked UN weapons inspectors from returning to the country for the past 4 years. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Dynegy Incorporated today agreed to pay Enron $25 million to settle the bankrupt company's claim that its one-time rival walked away from a proposed merger. That action hastened Enron's financial collapse. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished up 75 points to close at 88.18, that in heavy trading of about 1.5 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed up 10 points to finish at 13.44. The S&P 500 closed up 10 points. This is NPR News. More than 2 years after he died, Iowa farmer Dewey Beyer is reaching out to help his neighbors. An attorney representing the Beyer estate said today the money from the sale of his assets will be used to establish an investment trust, and the annual income on the trust will be used to pay a portion of the county's property taxes. It's not clear just how much money the trust will earn, but it's expected it could bring in as much as $150,000 each year. Former Georgia Sheriff Sidney Dorsey was sentenced to life in prison today for the murder of the man who replaced him in office. Dorsey also received another 23 years in prison on corruption charges. From Georgia Public Radio, Mike Savage reports.
The former DeKalb County Sheriff was convicted last month on charges of ordering the murder of Derwin Brown. Brown was fatally shot in December 2000, 3 days before he was to take office after beating Dorsey in a bitter runoff election. During the sentencing hearing, Dorsey maintained his innocence.
I'm going to be in prison on the outside, but I'll be free on the inside. because I do not have the blood of the sheriff-elect on my hands.
Dorsey was also found guilty of 11 other charges of widespread corruption in the sheriff's department, including racketeering, theft, and violation of oath of office. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
Mortgage rates have hit a new low. According to a nationwide survey, the rate for a 30-year mortgage has dropped to 6.22%. That's the lowest rate recorded since the industry began keeping records 32 years ago. The low rates are feeding a boom in mortgage refinancing. Officials say that refinancing activity last week represented almost 69% of all mortgage loan applications. I'm Dale Willman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. It's hot out. Right now, the Northeast is suffering through record-high temperatures. A new book, Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, looks back at the summer of 1995, when, according to author Eric Kleinenberg, 739 people died of heat-related causes in one blistering week. To put this in context, he points out that the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 killed half that many, the San Francisco earthquake of 1989 killed 62, and Hurricane Andrew killed 26. Kleinenberg says that we don't generally think of heat waves as natural disasters or serious public health hazards, but we should. An assistant professor of sociology at New York University, Kleinenberg decided to conduct a social autopsy when weather scientists couldn't account for the high death toll in Chicago that summer. Though it wasn't the longest heat wave ever in the city, the weather was extreme.
The roads buckled. There were problems with train rails. The power went out for 200,000 people in the city over the course of the week. 50,000 people suffered a loss of power when one substation alone went out. In the poor neighborhoods in Chicago where there weren't many publicly air-conditioned places, residents opened up the fire hydrants, and 3,000 fire hydrants were opened during the weekend. At one point, several communities on the south side lost their water pressure, so there were places in Chicago that had no energy and no water during this period of intense and dangerous heat.
How many days did it take before the city saw its first deaths from the heat, and how fast did the casualties mount once they started?
Among the first deaths in Chicago were two toddlers who were being cared for at a home daycare center where the woman providing the service had taken 8 or 10 children out in a van to go to an air-conditioned movie theater and get a quick bite to eat. And when she brought the children in, she forgot about two of them and left them in the car where the temperatures quickly spiked to 160 or 170 degrees. And those first two deaths presaged what the city was about to see. On a typical day in July of Chicago, about 72 people die. This week, the death toll spiked incredibly. On one day, there were about 350 deaths, another more than 200. In all for the week, medical researchers now know that there were 739 people in excess of the norm who died in Chicago. It was a death toll that, like nothing the city had ever seen.
Apparently, the morgue in Chicago ran out of bays to put the bodies. How did the city deal with the body count?
Well, the fast-thinking medical examiner at Donahue realized he needed lots of assistance to store the bodies. He put out a call to the owner of a refrigerated truck company, and this man was willing to send some vehicles into the morgue. At first, he sent two or three, and quickly they filled up, and he sent more, and they filled up as well. By the end of the week, there were 9, or according to one report, 10, 48-foot-long refrigerated meatpacking trucks right in the center of the city storing the bodies that the morgue couldn't handle. And you can imagine this is a kind of surreal scene in a city like Chicago, the famous meatpacking city of Upton Sinclair. And here we had this kind of return of the repressed in American life in dramatic fashion. So many dead bodies in the center of the city that almost no one could make sense of what had happened.
Yeah, you know, this is really horrific, and I don't even know how to phrase this. I'm sure the horrible irony of this isn't lost on you, that these people who died of excessive heat were then stored in refrigerated trucks to preserve their corpses.
No, it's something I say in Heat Wave, that one of the sad aspects of the story is that people got the kind of attention that would have saved their lives, artificial cooling and a care of public service workers, only after they died. You know, one of the points that I make in the book is that Chicago and the nation more generally has had real trouble coming to terms with what happened here during that week. And in part, I think it's because the stories we tell ourselves about what happened in American cities in the 1990s don't fit well with the story of Chicago in 1995. Chicago was in the midst of a period of great prosperity, a major economic boom and revitalization. The streets were coming to life. There were new trees and planters everywhere you looked. There was a kind of jubilant rhetoric about the turnaround that the city had, and it was preparing for the National Democratic Convention, which would come to kind of restore the reputation of Chicago. And suddenly we see these dozens and then hundreds of deaths right in the heart of Chicago, and these bodies get delivered to the morgue, literally just a few miles from the Loop.
I think at one point the city buried 68 people during this crisis in a trench. Is this right?
That's right. About a month after July, there were so many unclaimed bodies in Chicago that the county had to deal with the remains. And as they typically do, they brought in a truck and moved the bodies to a cemetery of a suburb on the south side. And their cemetery workers dug a trench that was about 160 feet long and 10 feet wide and buried 68 people, 41 of whom were heat victims and 27 of whom were people who just died around the city and had no one come to claim their bodies. And they were buried together in the end. When I show this image to people for the first time, they typically think it's a shot of Bosnia or El Salvador in the 1980s, some faraway war zone, a world that's totally different from our own. And when I tell them it's Chicago, and more than that, Chicago during this period of great prosperity, they find it hard to believe.
It's interesting, when you interviewed Chicago residents later, after about a month after the heat wave, they had the impression that only about 100 people died. And when I talked to people around town here, do you remember, you know, 1995 in Chicago? They had that same impression. Do you think this is because of denial or bad memory, or the fact that we distrust the media to report numbers, or what? How do you explain it?
Well, it's some combination of all of those things. From the moment that the heat hit the city, the collective and particularly the political response to the disaster has been marked by denial of what happened. And if you think about the contrast here between the story of the heat wave in Chicago and other American disasters, it's pretty revealing. In other circumstances, we all know that local officials are exceedingly quick to declare an official emergency or disaster, in part so they can get federal assistance funds and call attention to what's happening in their town. In Chicago, the opposite process was at work. When the medical examiner began to issue his death reports, the mayor of the city, Richard Daley, immediately told reporters not to blow the week out of proportion, and he questioned the scientific legitimacy of the medical examiner's findings. This sparked a political and scientific controversy in the city, one that local journalists quickly picked up into this scandalous debate over whether the deaths were really real or whether they had somehow been fabricated by the medical examiner himself.
I think there's some other things at work here too, though. Isn't it that people don't really consider heat a disaster because you can't really see it? There are no really big pictures on TV that, you know, for instance, when there's a hurricane, you see evidence of the disaster. It's such a silent, invisible death that so many of these people suffered.
I think you're right. It's not easy to picture a heat wave if you close your eyes and try to imagine what a hurricane or a tornado or a flood looks like. Images come very quickly to your mind.
And TV cameras can glom onto them. I mean, they can put things on TV.
Absolutely. I say we all carry stock photos of those disasters in our minds because we've seen them so many times on television or on the front pages of our newspapers. But heat waves don't make good television, and they don't make good news graphics most of the time. They're these invisible killers, as you said, and so we're somewhat skeptical about them. And I think the other thing, in contrast to the other disasters we've described, is that for many people, heat waves are very easy to manage. You go to your office or to your home, and you turn the button on your air conditioner, and suddenly everything is okay. Heat waves are less universal disasters. They pinpoint the vulnerable and poor people who can't defend themselves, and I think for many of us, that's hard to understand.
I'm speaking with Eric Kleinenberg. He's an assistant professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. We're going to take a break now, Eric, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with my guest, sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. His new book about a disaster which claimed the lives of more than 700 people in Chicago in the summer of 1995 is called Heat Wave. What are some of the factors that you considered in looking at how isolated these elderly people were who died alone? And I'm thinking when I hear about these heat waves and I hear about these elderly people found dead at home with the windows shut. Yeah. I think, what? How did that happen? Did they not have the strength to open their windows, or were they afraid that they'd get robbed if they did open their windows? How did this happen?
Well, I think the association between the high neighborhood crime levels and the high death rate provides part of your answer, that people who live in areas where they know that they're more likely to be victims of crime are themselves interested in providing kind of makeshift security systems. Since they typically can't afford to have expensive, you know, private home alarms, they'll do things like have neighbors or relatives come and seal shut their windows, or in some cases nail shut the windows, you know, really safeguarding the apartment. They'll lock or sometimes double lock their doors. Sometimes they're skeptical when someone knocks and looks in on them, part because they're worried that it could be a predator of some kind. And when they're living in neighborhoods with high crime and violence, they become more likely to shut themselves in and use this kind of reclusion as a safety strategy.
You read police reports of these deaths. What struck you about those?
There's a short and crisp and brutal language that we use to make sense of death. Sometimes it's clinical if it comes from medical researchers or a medical examiner. Sometimes it's just more curt and social, like when it comes from a police officer doing an investigation. I was able to track down the police reports from a number of people who died that week. I found one, for example, that simply listed the following items.
Female, age 73, white, July 17th, 1995. A recluse for 10 years, never left apartment. Found today by son, apparently DOA. Conditions in apartment when responding officers arrived. Thermostat was registering over 90 degrees Fahrenheit with no air circulation except for windows opened by sun after death. Possible heat-related death. Had a known heart problem 10 years ago, but never completed medication or treatment. And that was it. There were dozens of accounts like this, and they left me with a kind of partial sense of the stories of these people, this kind of secret society of people who lived and died alone, but I was not satisfied by it. I felt as if there was much more to say when there's so many hundreds of people who die and die alone in a booming city. That's something we need to understand outside of the medical vocabulary or the vocabulary of the police report.
You also went through the boxes holding the personal effects of people who had died alone during the heat wave and who had no one to claim their things. Were you trying to get a sense of who they were?
I was, exactly. It was almost impossible to understand what happens to people who die alone and are out of contact with the world around them. You obviously can't speak with them. By definition, there weren't other people watching them, spending time with them as they perished. And so there are no last-minute accounts that you can get in most cases. And so I felt through much of the process of writing this book that there was a story I couldn't quite get at. And then I learned about the public administrator's office that investigates these cases where people die and have no one to come and claim the body or the estate. And I got in touch with the office in Chicago, and they invited me to come in and look at the files that remained. They had done about 170 investigations during the week of the heat wave. That means that there were at least 170 people who died alone and then had no one come to claim them until an investigation started. And by the time I got there, there were about 60 completed files of cases that had still never been claimed. And an administrative officer picked up a box, and the assistant picked up another one or two, and they put them in a small room and left me there with them. And suddenly, after years of trying to understand this event, I was face to face with the personal effects of dozens of the victims. I started opening the envelopes and came across watches and wallets, personal letters, photographs from the room. In one case, I found this file of a man who had been a decorated war veteran who had won a Bronze Star and had a certificate for his contributions in war, and a photograph of him as a young soldier sat just a few feet from the place where he died alone. And I think one disturbing experience, you know, based on this, or the kind of knowledge from this, is the sense that at one point someone could be so successful, so socially integrated, so alive and connected, and not long after be found dead and alone in an American city.
Now, part of your book is an indictment of how the city of Chicago responded to the crisis in 1995. What were some of the city's massive failures?
The public health emergency programs in Chicago were completely overwhelmed during the week. There were thousands of calls for emergency medical care, for paramedics, and the fire department, which manages emergency medical care in Chicago, was so overwhelmed that their response times were delayed. In many cases, it took more than 30 minutes to reach someone, and at least one case, the wait was over 70 minutes. and the ambulances were extraordinarily busy, so much so that the department was using fire trucks to respond to emergency calls. Now, there are several paramedics in Chicago who reported to me that they made specific requests to higher-ups in the department for more ambulances and for more paramedic staff, but had their request turned down. They felt like they weren't being taken seriously by the administration. And you can see this through the city's response to the mounting disaster in several levels. There was no capacity to coordinate the emergency health system, for example. At one point, 18 different emergency rooms in Chicago closed their doors to new patients. They went on bypass status, and 23 hospitals in the city, almost half in Chicago, closed. And there was no administration of this. There was no one putting it all together from above. The city has a famous community policing program, one that's designed to have officers on the streets getting to know residents, providing special kinds of support and care. And yet, no one activated the officers who are in charge of providing for seniors doing this community work during the week. And in part, I think the problem was that there was no leadership from above issuing an emergency that would trigger a sense of danger in all of the departments. The responsibilities were so diffuse that no one could see what was happening. The event unfolded as a series of isolated and segmented problems, in part because city governments have become so segmented. And in this case, I think that segmentation made it difficult to recognize what happened in the city.
Eric Kleinenberg's new book is Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Linley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television. And by Columbia Records and the James Taylor album, October Road, which features 12 new performances, available in stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, comedian and insomniac Dave Attell talks about life on the other side of midnight. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back at an obscure Southern soul music label. And we conclude our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg about the deadly Chicago heat wave of 1995.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Eric Kleinenberg. His new book, Heat Wave, examines one sweltering week in 1995 in Chicago when 739 people died. Chicago and other cities are looking at what went wrong that summer in order to better protect vulnerable citizens from the heat. Now, there are some simple solutions to excessive heat that we've had since the mid-20th century. You turn on an air conditioner, and of course, you have to have an air conditioner, and you have to be able to afford the electricity for it if you do have it. But these aren't really insurmountable problems for a city government, are they? I mean, if you have an emergency response team and people are knocking on doors trying to see if there are people home alone in danger of heat exhaustion, that they could reach these people and do something. How do air conditioners and air conditioning fit into this whole mess?
Well, heat is very easy to combat if you have an air conditioner and if you can afford the energy to use it. Some people think that providing air conditioners to more people in cities would make for a good public health solution. As expensive as it would be, it would be a fraction of the cost that we spend to react to other major disasters. Of course, we'd also need to provide guarantees for summer energy the way that we do for winter heat. Collectively, we've recognized that it is cruel and inhumane to leave Americans without heat in the winter. But we don't have that same sensibility about summer heat. We don't provide cooling. So perhaps that's an area that we could investigate more seriously collectively, particularly now that we know that heat waves do kill more Americans than all of these other disasters combined. There are some other things that city governments can do to protect residents from the dangers of summer heat. And in fact, Chicago does most of them now. For example, there's a heat weather warning system developed by a geographer, Lawrence Kochstein, in Delaware, that many cities use, including Philadelphia. And the system is able to distinguish between truly dangerous summer weather and ordinary heat. And when cities use it, they can oftentimes predict a dangerous climate long before it arrives. Once they do, there are a number of steps cities can take to trigger these emergency programs. You mentioned cooling centers, and cities can open them, but they have to make sure that the people who would use them can get there, and so it's important to have special public transportation programs set up. In order to recognize who's at risk, cities also need to be aware about this emerging population of people who are old and poor and living alone during normal times. In Chicago today, the local government does quite a lot to keep track of who is vulnerable in the city. They have names and addresses and phone numbers. And when there's extreme summer weather, city workers and volunteers go to the Heat Command Center and make phone calls checking up on people who are at risk. The community police officers and other city workers actually do go door to door sometimes. And the city is quick to call local media and urge them to make public warnings.
There's an energy issue here, though, while we're talking about cooling and air conditioners. And one of the problems Chicago had in 1995 and all major cities have during these heat waves is blackouts and rolling blackouts. And I understand also in Chicago that the heat itself overwhelmed their technology, that the system kind of burnt up.
There were so many people using air conditioning in Chicago that the power grids broke down and the heat systems, the energy systems literally burst into flames. Here there's another story to tell about the politics of air conditioners. We're currently engaged in some major discussions at the federal level about the standards we should hold air conditioning makers to when they produce their units. We can produce more energy-efficient air conditioning units with a grade of 13 that limits the amount of energy that they demand when they're in use. In fact, that was a standard that President Clinton set. But when President Bush came into office, he lowered that standard from 13 to 12. And although it might appear to be a somewhat innocuous decision, in fact, that means that when city residents use those air conditioners, they'll need more energy. And in order to provide the energy, there'll be more utilities companies building more plants. And until that happens, there'll probably be more cities having electrical shortages and people both paying more for their energy and also being more vulnerable to power outages.
How well do you think major cities in the country are prepared for heat waves now? Have they learned from the example of Chicago and the past, heat waves in the past?
I think that some have. Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, St. Louis, Milwaukee, there are some cities that have experienced extreme heat waves themselves or have learned from Chicago and are now trying to do something about it. But my sense is that for the most part, it remains a kind of invisible crisis in the United States today, that it's not a matter of national significance. And for example, we haven't had congressional hearings about the dangers of summer weather. As far as I know, there are no major federal reports that urge cities to implement a series of public health protection strategies. And my sense is it's still somewhat off the radar screen. Clearly, what happened in Chicago in 1995 signaled a warning to many public health experts and city leaders. But was the warning strong enough? I don't know.
Eric Kleinenberg, thanks very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Kleinenberg's new book is Heat Wave. Coming up, a travel show for people who can't sleep. This is Fresh Air. Every major city has a tourist board whose mission is to present their town in the best, purest, and most sparkling light. Dave Attell might well be their worst nightmare.
Come with me and you will see a late night freak show, Jubilee. Kick the Sandman in his sack. Stay up late, Insomniac.
Attell is a stand-up comedian and host of the late night show Insomniac with Dave Attell on Comedy Central. Every show begins with a snippet of Attell's stand-up act from a comedy club somewhere in North America. Then Attell and his crew wander through the streets until dawn, visiting bars, factories, more bars, 24-hour stores, and various strange and wondrous clubs, private parties, and tourist destinations. Attell's adventures have taken him to a cockfight in Tijuana and a night out with aging strippers in Kansas City. The show is a cross-country nocturnal romp with a very politically incorrect, off-color guide. As it turns out, this is a dream job for Attell, a lifelong insomniac. Here he is in Atlanta visiting a projectionist of the all-night Starlight Drive-In movie theater.
So Paul's changing reels now for Lord of the Rings. Will Frodo get rid of the evil ring? Who knows? It's really up to Paul. While you're out there in your car steaming up those windows, making that fender bounce, Paul's back here making sure you have a movie to watch when you come up for air or, you know, open the condom or unscrew the lube or relight the, you know. It's not a family show, all right?
What I enjoy about the mix that Insomniac has is that it is kind of part travel show where you do see parts of cities you might never, ever get to as a traveler. It's also kind of part comedy. And what's really good about it is that there's so many travel shows that are just aimed at the upper crust with this sonorous voiced narrator intoning platitudes over these aerial shots of the French Riviera. And your show is such an antidote to that.
Yeah, I try and show the exotic side to like a town like Kansas City or Charleston, West Virginia, Nashville, like
you know, small towns. Like, I that's where I get the biggest kick out of it, which is, like, going to a real small town, like, showing, you know, just something, I guess, if we can find it, something that, like, not many people know about, you know? But you're right. It's not like the French Riviera, or we're going to the Cannes Film Festival, or the, you know, romantic islands of Greece or anything like that. It's basically, you know, kind of right off the highway stuff. It's about the whole country, and it involves every type of people, which is, you know, whether you're, you know, any ethnicity, any sexual preference, any philosophy is all warranted as long as you're up late. And sometimes all those elements get together, and it's incredibly boring. And that's what we try and show, too, which is like, you know, it could be a hot fetish club somewhere, and nothing's going on. You know, it's like, here you are, deviant, fetish, you know, crazy, wild stuff, and nothing's happening. And I think that's funny, too, you know?
Well, that is. You I think you go to a male club, and they're getting piercings in various, very sensitive parts of their anatomy. And it's nothing. It's kind of boring. It's really just a party.
But that was my favorite bit. I'm glad you brought that. That's in Boise, Idaho at the fetish club. I guess it was, what you call alternative lifestyle club. Those guys were great. Like, they were so much fun, and they were like, you know, just hanging out, and we were all kind of laughing at the situation. Even the guys getting the piercings, you know, cause I believe the head guy and his partner there, they were like, I can't believe we're doing this. And then they would just start giggling, and I was like laughing at them, taking the pictures. You know, sometimes I feel like, you know, am I ruining the good time? Like, this would have been a better time if I wasn't here with my camera and everything like that. But people really get off on it, you know? I guess everybody wants to be on TV now. That's basically it.
Well, I'm thinking in one episode you do go to a strip club for older strippers. I forget where it is in the country. And one of the women crushes beer cans between her breasts. And this on the surface of it, sounds like a kind of sad, sordid story, but it's not that way at all. It really seems like a party, mostly because you don't make fun of the people you talk to. Do you find yourself holding yourself back?
That strip club was at in Atlanta called the Claremont, which is like the oldest strip club, I think, in Atlanta. And holding back is I guess, you know, I'm just glad that these people are hanging out with me. So it's not like I'm really holding back. I hold back in other situations on the show, like with the drunks on the street. We try not to show people who are super drunk. And I don't, like, gun them. I don't, like, really attack them like I would in a stand-up club. See, that's the big difference. Like, when I do my act live, like, if somebody heckles me, I'll attack them. You know, like, it'll be like what you've seen in comedy clubs. But, like, when I do my show, it's really basically I want everyone to feel comfortable. Like, they're all a part of it. You know, they make the show. I appreciate them being on the show. And unless they're outrageously drunk, we're not going to show them on the show, you know?
You know, it's funny that you describe the show as reality TV, and I guess it is in a sense, but there's this explosion.
It's reality-based.
Yeah, there's this explosion of reality TV programming on the wet networks now, and most of it is very different. It's more exploitative, or it's violent, or it's just really horribly pathetic.
There's all these reality shows out there, and a lot of them has to do with people doing you know, crazy, outlandish things. And I'm not going to say we've never shown that kind of stuff on our show, but it's really such a basic show. It's really about me. I'm the biggest loser on the show. I have a couple of drinks. I try and see some sights, hook up with someone who's working late. It's so basic, you know. I wish there was a philosophy to it. You know, it's like the Iliad, or a man searching for himself, or, you know, man's inhumanity against Jägermeister, something. I don't know. What do you like about my show, Barbara? What do you like about it?
I like it best when you talk to people who are working at the supermarket, the night shift, late at night, and talk to the meat guy.
Yeah, I like that too. I like it when you get to, like, talk to a guy doing a job that, like, a lot of these jobs, like, I always wondered about, but I've never actually seen done. Like, we were at a steel mill, and I was like, you know, everybody thinks of steel mill like, I don't know, like the first scene of The Deer Hunter, you know, pouring out that molten steel and everything. But there's so much work that goes into it, and it's like such an involved process. And it's really like, you really got to know like a million different like disciplines, like chemistry and metallurgy and all that kind of stuff. I mean, these are like real, like blue collar dudes and women, but they like talk like they're scientists. It's amazing.
Well, yeah, and so much on TV is the scripted stuff or the late night talk shows you have where you pretty much know exactly what's going to happen and everybody's so smooth and everybody looks good, and that this is such a departure from that.
Yeah, I think that's what people like about the show, which is that they show me when I screw up and I'm not an actor and I'm not really a good host. That's the thing about it. It's like I'm not a good host. And I always thought that that was holding back the show. Which is like, I'm not really good at introducing things like, and now we're going to go to this place. And have you ever thought about doing blah, blah? Well, let's go. I'm really not good at that. I'm not comfortable like that. But I think once I get in the bit, I feel like, you know, there's like funny stuff to talk about, try and involve as many people, you know, make it like a party. That's what I can do.
What does Dawn feel like?
I love Dawn. I like Just as the Sun's Coming Up. And I hope this doesn't sound too like, you know, commercial or whatever, but like Just as the Sun's Coming Up, and it's just right before like the traffic hits and like right before the real day begins, I feel like I'm the coolest guy in the world. Like I'm up, I'm the last man standing. Everybody else went to bed, everybody else wussed out, I made it. You know, it's a new day, you know, who knows what's going to happen, I made it, now I can go to sleep.
Dave Attell, host of Comedy Central's Insomniac, which airs Sunday nights at 11:30. Attell performs his stand-up act next week at the Punchline in San Francisco. In September, he appears in Pittsburgh, New York, and Boston. Today is the birthday of jazz pianist Oscar Peterson. He was born 77 years ago. Here's his 1959 recording of Cole Porter's In the Still of the Night. Oscar Peterson on piano. Coming up, the story of Mirko Records. This is Fresh Air. there's a rich heritage of independent record labels in this country stretching from the late 1940s to the present day. In the 60s, they tended to be in the South. And today, Ed Ward tells the story of one of the most obscure, Mirco Records of Shreveport, Louisiana.
When Dee Murray bought the Bayou Record Store in Shreveport, Louisiana in 1960, he changed the face of the Southern record business in two ways. The most notable was that the Bayou's former owner, Shelby Singleton Jr., headed to Nashville, where he began a long and colorful career that would bring us everyone from Jeannie C. Riley to Orion, the Maybe Elvis. Less notable was the fact that Murray started a handful of labels to record local country, rock, and soul talent. Mirco, his soul label, deserves to be better known.
I'm a losing boy, 'cause my baby is gone. I got the lovesick blues, so all I do is weep and moan. I have lost my chance and her romance, 'cause I'm a losing boy. I'm through with romance.
Eddie Giles' Losin' Boy was his first and only hit. Murray had been after Giles, a local gospel singer, to cut a soul record, and it took a while, but in 1967 he finally succeeded. The record took off in Dallas and then in various other locations in the South, and even charted for a brief moment. Giles went on to record more singles for Murray and later for other producers, but he wound up back in the church and hosts a gospel radio show in Shreveport to this day. If Eddie Giles was the up-tempo soul man, Reuben Bell was the ballad specialist.
You say forget you, find me somebody new. It's not that easy when I placed all my faith in you.
Songs like It's Not That Easy show a man with an expressive, soulful voice, and if the backup, always the weak point on these small-label Southern Soul records, isn't so good, you just don't notice it when Bell's voice is up front. Like Eddie Giles, Reuben Bell is still in Shreveport and released an album as late as 1982. Dory Grayson's still there, too, teaching school. I wonder how many of her students know this side of her.
I don't care if you got someone new.
Grayson released six singles for Mirco, and none of them went anywhere, which is a shame because, as you can hear, she had some good material to work with. A lot of the problems labels like Mirco had were due to the fact that they weren't in the big cities, and neither was their audience. They weren't hip to the latest fashions in music, and so a lot of their records were a bit behind the curve. None of Dee Murray's productions shows this better than Charles Crawford's A Sad, Sad Song, which would have been a hit in 1968.
Feeling sorry for yourself and spending your nights alone. I say go on, keep on drinking that wine. Thank you.
a sad, sad song came out in 1973, long after such Otis Redding-flavored deep soul had been popular nationally. It was Crawford's only 45, although I understand he still performs around Dallas occasionally. Another thing small labels like Mirco are good for, though, are singles nobody else would record or release, and Ann Alford's 145 for High Sign, Mirco's successor, in 1972, was certainly that.
Well, I guess I'm gonna have to get me a job, 'cause ain't one thing on the streets no more. Now I've been hustling for all my life, playing cards, dice, and other games, and I'm broke just the same. I guess I'll get me a job. I guess I'll get me a job.
Talk about a slice of life. Apparently, Ann and her husband, Don, showed up in Shreveport, cut the record, and left town. It and its flip side, If It Ain't One Thing, It's Another, are vignettes that are just too real and sordid to be hits, but they're fascinating documents. Dee Murray wound down his record labels in the 70s and closed Bayou Records in 1994. He, like so many of his artists, is still in Shreveport, remembered by a handful of European soul fanatics.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He played music from Shreveport Southern Soul, The Mirco Story, compiled by Ace Records of London. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our show was produced today by Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
To worry about you, baby. Oh, but I ain't gonna worry no more. So if you want to, I'm not gonna stop you. I'm gonna let you just walk out the door. 'Cause I know I've done my part, and what I've done for you was right my part. I used to worry. Oh, baby, I ain't gonna worry no more. Oh, no. If you get lonesome after you're gone,
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of The Dying Animal, the new paperback by Philip Roth, author of American Pastoral. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's the 25th anniversary of the King's demise. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Sam Phillips. He discovered Elvis Presley. Also band members DJ Fontana and Scotty Moore, and Elvis's biographer, Peter Guralnick. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Got my baby and gone.